First of all, Ankara has recently claimed that the recent deployment of troops to Iraq was part of an international train and equip program. However, some analysts highly doubt that Turkey acted on that ground. What's your take on the situation?
Well, I join those analysts who are skeptical. The Turks have been very aggressive in recent years, and the soldiers that they've put into Iraq, I think, are part of that general pattern. And the fact that the Iraqi government has asked them formally to leave, and they've said no, they won't, shows that they're on their own. They're doing what they want. There's no international law.
There were some stories that were out there that said that the Turkish army had actually gone into northern Iraq in order to hide or in order to obfuscate the oil trade that had been taking part in that area. Is there any truth to those rumors, or are those just rumors?
I can't speak specifically to that, but I can say that the Turkish government now for over a year has been supporting Daesh or ISIS or Islamic State, ISIL, we'll call it what you will, in a variety of ways, including purchasing the oil from there, providing medical facilities, providing arms, providing a vehicle for money and personnel. So there's no question that the Turkish government is supporting ISIS. Whether or not they are doing specifically, as you suggest, in Iraq, I don't know. But it certainly would fit the general pattern.
Interesting. Now, is this one of these stories where strange situations make for strange bedfellows? Or are they actively pursuing or trying to enable Daesh or ISIS to further whatever agenda that Turkey has?
The Turks are not specifically enthusiastic about ISIS' grandiose caliphate and ambitions to rule the whole Muslim world. It is enthusiastic, however, about ISIS fighting the Kurds in Syria and potentially in Iraq. It's enthusiastic about ISIS being a bulwark against the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. So there is significant overlap, though not complete harmony, between the Turkish government, Ankara, and ISIS.
I see. Well, going back to Iraq now, Turkey has continued to refuse to withdraw its troops from Iraq, despite Baghdad's warnings. Apparently, the 48 hours granted for withdrawal is set to run out this evening. How do you see the situation developing?
Well, I see the Iraqi government in Baghdad becoming more hostile towards Ankara, which is exactly what Ankara doesn't need. It's surrounded by hostile states. States that it has made hostile by its own actions, of starting with Russia, but also now Iraq and the Syrian government and the Israeli government, the Egyptian government, the Cypriot government, the Greek government, the governments of the United States and China. And you know, everywhere you look, there are governments that are hostile to Ankara. And now Iraq is even more hostile than it was before.
I see. Well, it definitely seems as if more and more countries of the world are having a presence inside of Iraq or inside of Syria, definitely. With that in mind, some analysts have claimed that Turkey could be willing to plunge Iraq into chaos with the support of Iraqi Kurdistan. How realistic does that sound to you?
It's very complex because the Turkish government has significant problems with its own Kurdish population, as well as the Kurdish population of Syria. However, it gets along well with the Kurdish government of northern Iraq and has been using it as a vehicle to oppose the Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad. There's so many moving parts here, but the basic confrontation is between the Sunni bloc of Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey on the one hand, and the Shiite bloc of Iran, Hezbollah, and other smaller groups on the other hand. They're fighting in Yemen, they're fighting in Syria, they're fighting in Iraq, and potentially in Lebanon. And this is the driving force of Middle East politics today.
Well, you're talking about the Sunni-Shia divide.
That's right. Something which had been pretty much gone 40, 50 years ago, but has come back with a real vengeance and is now, as I say, the motor force of Middle East politics.
Well, do you feel that that would be because of the Wahhabism that Saudi Arabia actively promotes, and they do have very deep pockets?
That's certainly one factor, but the other factor is the Khomeini Revolution of 1978-79, which led to a radical Shiite version of Islamism. So on both sides, there's an upping of the stakes and antagonism and bellicosity, and we're seeing it play out in Syria and Iraq. And where it's going to lead, I can't say, but my expectation is that these two states, which are basically failed states, are going to crack into three parts, each of them, into a Shiite-dominated central government, or Shiite-oriented central government, a Sunni opposition, Arab opposition, and a Kurdistan that wants out, doesn't want to be part of this Arab state.
Are you specifically talking about Iraq here, or you mentioned three states? Are we talking about Syria, Iraq, and maybe Afghanistan?
No, Syria, two states, Iraq and Syria. I see them splintering in parallel fashion with a Kurdistan, a Sunni area, and a Shiite-dominant area.
I see. And in this scenario, the conflict would remain local to some extent. It would remain inside of the Middle East then. And I ask that because it seems as if a large part of the major world powers are having a presence in the area.
They are, but it's not a very serious presence, because if the major world powers really wanted to get rid of ISIS, they could do so rather quickly. ISIS has a fighting force that's estimated at 50,000. If one takes the Russian military, the American military, the British, the French, and others that are engaged in the skies over Syria, and put them on the ground and had them really forcefully attack ISIS, it would be gone very quickly. But they're not doing that. They're just bombing from the air. And we know that bombing from the air, in general, doesn't lead to successful results. My iron law of warfare is, unless you're willing to put in ground troops, don't go to war. It means you're not serious. You're not really, you know, willing to pay the political price of winning a war. Don't even start it.
I see. And yet people are still bombing, and there is talk of putting ground troops. At least America has put in some 50 special operations forces, and there's talk of putting more in. I'd like to go back to something you briefly touched upon when you mentioned that the Turkish government has its internal politics, it has its internal problems with the Kurdish population. As minority as they are, they represent, I think, less than 10% of the entire Turkish population. And yet, they have a working relationship with the Kurds in northern Iraq. So with that in mind, what do the Kurds in northern Iraq think about the situation of Turkish soldiers being inside of Iraq?
I think the general estimate is 15 to 20% of the population of Turkey is Kurdish. What is the attitude of the Kurdish regional government in northern Iraq towards Turkish soldiers? Quite benign. They don't mind having fellow Sunnis in Iraq. They're worried about ISIS. They're not particularly worried, so far as I can tell, about the Turks there, because there is a, as I said before, a cooperation between the Kurds of Iraq and the Turkish government in Ankara. It gets very complicated very fast, because there's so many signs and there are different dimensions to the sign: the language, the religion, the sectarian, the state. And there's so many actors now.
Well, I guess the first thing, if I understood you correctly, the first thing that some of these soldiers would do then is ask, what religion are you? And not only what religion, but what particular branch of religion are you? Instead of saying, hey, you know, what nation are you from? I guess they don't really see each other as being from nation states, if I understood you correctly.
There is certainly a national side to it. But there are, as you correctly point out, also religious, sectarian, linguistic, and other attributes as well that go with it. And so what has, in a place like Syria today, so many different militias representing different outlooks, different goals, that it's a full-time study just to keep track of them.
Interesting. Well, Baghdad has pledged to appeal to the UN over Ankara's actions in Mosul. What possible implications could Ankara face, given if the case is considered by the UN?
I think there'll be a lot of sympathy for the Iraqi government. As I mentioned before, many states are really upset with Ankara, and that could well show up in a UN discussion. Nominally, the NATO allies of Turkey have supported it in the confrontation with the Russian Air Force. But in fact, there's a lot of grumbling. No one is happy about this confrontation. There's a general sense that the Turks have gone too far, have made a mistake, have brought them NATO into a situation it doesn't want to be. So there's resentment. And that's just one of many different resentments. The Europeans are deeply upset about the fact that the Turks have allowed these illegal immigrants to go by the hundreds of thousands into Europe now. And other governments are upset over other things. For example, the Chinese government is upset that the Turks are supporting a Turkish liberation movement in Western China.
And that would, of course, be with there's a small minority, a Muslim minority. I forget the exact name of this group there.
The Uyghurs.
Well,
small in the context of China with over 1 billion population, but they're on the order of 20 million people, so not that small.
I see. Well, if the case is considered by the UN, what could possibly happen? Are we talking about, I don't know, could they be reprimanded with a strong letter telling them exactly what they did wrong, or could there be something more serious that could happen?
I think it would be limited to a reprimand, a verbal reprimand. I don't think there'll be any steps taken. But it does point to the increasing isolation of Ankara, of the government headed, well, the government headed, formerly by Ahmet Davutoglu, but in fact headed by the supposedly nominally non-partisan President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is a very ambitious politician and who has done exceedingly well in Turkish politics, and who is therefore under the impression that the same kind of practices that he employs within Turkish politics can be used also outside it. And so, for example, the shooting down of the Russian plane a couple weeks ago is the sort of thing he would have done inside Turkey. It's the kind of bold, aggressive step he takes. And it works in Turkey. It doesn't work so well in the outside world.
And yet, using his bold, aggressive tactics that would have worked inside of his own country really puts a lot of nations at risk inside of the Middle East here. I mean, it just really seems as if every day we're hearing these stories that are growing in their sense that, I don't know, I just see doom, to be honest with you. I mean, what's your take on what will happen inside of Syria in the next, I don't know, weeks up to, let's say, 6 months?
Well, I see a further devolution of Syria into its three constituent parts. It's brutal, it's bloody, it's nasty, but what there is a separation of populations taking place that could eventually lead to some kind of settlement whereby the Damascus controls one part and the rebels control another part, the Kurds a third part. That would be the best scenario in my view.
And
not reconstituting.
Inside of that scenario, what happens to the refugees that have ended up in Europe? Do they get to go back home, or all of a sudden they're just a person without a country?
I can't imagine they'll be going home. I think they're permanently left. And this is part of the government's strategy of Bashar al-Assad to push out the people, in particular the Sunni Muslims, that are not welcome in his Syria. And they're leaving. And you mentioned Europe, but there are larger numbers in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. There's something in the order of 6 million refugees now outside of Syria.
I see.
Which is in a country of 22 million. That's a very substantial proportion.